Iran's de facto parties to the conflict. Also, according to Guardian, the UK said in February that it would begin training Ukrainian pilots in standard NATO techniques. And number 10 repeated that, saying the plan was to help build a new Ukrainian air force with NATO standard F-16 jets. Britain does not use F-16s, which are made by the US defense firm Lockheed Martin in South Carolina. Ukraine has been seeking to obtain them for some time to augment its small Soviet standard air force because they're widely available with about 3,000 in service in 25 countries. Both countries will have to persuade the US if Ukraine is to receive F-16s. Asked later if the US had changed its position on supplying the jets to Ukraine, John Kirby, spokesperson for the White House's National Security Council, gave a one-word reply, no.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on April 18th, 2023. What people say is what we are seeing now. That is, they elect someone as their president. That is, the words of the people. They elect some individuals to be representatives in the parliament. That is, the words of the people. This is how we know what people want. Now, one of the brothers here spoke about referendums. He said that if we had held referendums on all the issues that came up from the beginning, there wouldn't have been such sensitivity over the issue of referendums now. Where in the world do they do this? Can all the various issues of the country be put to a referendum? Do all the people who should and will take part in a referendum have the ability to analyse all the issues? How can you say such a thing? How can you hold a referendum on an issue where propaganda can be used? Or it can be discussed from all different angles. They get a country caught up in debates, arguments, discussions and polarisation for 6 months in order to hold a referendum on an issue. Should we hold referendums on all matters? It is not something that you can just pass by very easily. One problem is acting hastily. You should not act hastily.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A student talk should not just be for announcing the problems. I'm not saying that you shouldn't talk about the problems that exist, but don't just talk about the problems. There are also good shining points in the country. the students should mention them as well. They should mention both. In other words, they should not merely act as spreaders of these things and problems. They should not be hot-tempered or look at matters superficially. They should not nationalize a local problem. For example, sometimes an incident occurs in a corner of the country. Some student organization turns this into a national issue. This is wrong. It is detrimental to the country. This is not running away from the problem or responding to the problem. It is to the detriment of the country to turn a local problem into a national one. A student's intention should not be seeking fame. Look, I emphasize this. Neither an individual student nor a student association should say things just to be seen. It will take the blessings away from the things you do and speak of. It will minimize the effect of what you say. And of course, it is harmful.
I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a 2-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now. Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence, and this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally, but the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked, but France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting, calling it not useful and a one-way monologue. The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages, but all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government,
Unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hundreds of Orthodox Jews protested outside the UK Parliament building on Tuesday over fears the establishment will begin regulating traditional Jewish faith schools known as yeshivot. Protest leaders made clear they considered any legislation targeting unregulated Jewish religious institutions as anti-Semitic, and they may be forced to flee Britain to protect their religious freedoms from unwelcome reforms.
Today, we face a concerning challenge as politicians attempt to push through a proposed register for children educated outside of school. This is no ordinary bill, but one that seeks to sneak in new laws through the back door under the guise of a private member's bill. This register proposal targets our strictly Orthodox Jewish community, intending to undermine our way of life more than any other group. It reeks of state-sponsored anti-Semitism.
What concerns these religious Jewish parents is regulated British education mandates lessons on lifestyles which contradict Jewish religious beliefs, including relationship and sex education, or RSE, LGBT propaganda, and other anti-religious ideologies, including atheism.
Well, we're not talking about murdering anybody. We're just talking about what we don't want our children to be taught. And we're just following what it says in our religion. And it's absolutely disgraceful that you're not allowed to do that in this country. And that's anti-Semitic.
These protests come after years of public anger expressed by parents, particularly British Muslims, over RSE lessons already being implemented in state schools. Opt-out options are not available, and accusations of indoctrination or anti-religious propaganda being fed to young children has been rife. In January 2023, a petition went viral, gaining over 200,000 signatures, demanding the government remove LGBT teaching from the controversial curriculum. The government responded, saying,
"The statutory guidance states that all pupils should receive teaching on LGBT content during their school years. Secondary schools should include LGBT content in their teaching. Primary schools are strongly encouraged and enabled when teaching about different types of family to include families with same-sex parents."
The ruling Conservative government has routinely attacked left-wing opposition over their support for the Palestinian cause and their criticism of Britain's relationship with the Israeli regime. However, and quite ironically, it's now number 10 that finds itself on the receiving end of not only accusations of anti-Semitism, but also Islamophobia and for being anti-religion in general, over an education system which is perceived to be discriminating against religious minority rights. Robert Carter, London.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima is set to host a G7 summit this week, where leaders of the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Italy, and Japan will address pressing global issues. The meeting is also a source of controversy in other countries around the world, including South Korea, where activists at a Seoul forum slammed the event as diplomatic whitewashing.
This summit is a tool to conceal the terrible truth that countless Asian and Pacific people had to bleed due to 50 years of Japanese imperialism beginning in the late 19th century. It's a blindfold to cover Japan's hypocritical steps towards nuclear-free world, peace, and rearmament while dumping nuclear-contaminated water and scrapping its peace constitution.
South Korea's relations with Japan have always been controversial, but especially now as President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to improve ties against the wishes of many South Koreans, who demand an apology for what they call Japan's colonial abuses.
As world leaders flock to Hiroshima, South Koreans are reminded of a history the U.S. and Japan might rather forget. When the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, in addition to more than 200,000 Japanese, estimates suggest some 40,000 Koreans were killed. Many of them were forced laborers.
Some South Koreans say President Yoon is moving the country too close to the United States and a military alliance with Japan, which is seen as increasing regional tension. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida invited Yoon to the G7.
The South Korean government's participation is mainly to strengthen military cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, and further strengthen military cooperation with NATO, which is mainly led by the United States. If South Korea's participation in the G7 was to reinforce the military alliance as a benefit, that can never be a good thing for the peace of the Korean Peninsula, as well as world peace.
While the summit plans to address the Russia-Ukraine war and economic issues, activists also argue the rich G7 nations need to do more to solve the humanitarian crisis now unfolding in East Africa. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A new report by the Institute of Watson Brown on their Costs of War project, which evaluates the results of the post-9/11 wars on affected countries, says the post-9/11 wars have caused more than 4.5 million people to lose their life in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan. This study says that some of these people were killed in the war, but a larger number died indirectly due to the destructive effects of the war, which reaches 3.7 million people.
These mentioned casualties have different reasons. One is that the treatment centers have been destroyed due to war, and medical aid seekers could not access treatment. Also, the widespread of diseases due to lack of health centers is countable. We can even refer to using bombs and weapons used in war that had environmental consequences that affected people. Overall destruction of infrastructures and long-term effects of the war is the main reason for casualties.
According to the report, tens of millions of people living in the war zones have also been displaced. The U.S. post-9/11 wars have forcibly displaced at least 38 million people in and from Afghanistan and the other mentioned countries.
Taking responsibility has three steps. First is to acknowledge they are the cause of this destruction and misery, which they don't. Second is ethical acceptance of the results of what they have done. And finally, there should be a higher power to compel them to take responsibility for what they have done. Some might say the UN is a higher power. Still, the UN is created by some countries which have the right or the veto right, and it shows flexibility towards these countries. There is simply no base on which these countries take responsibility.
The results of the war imposed by the U.S. on Afghanistan are the shocking numbers of 30% rise in food insecurity, 41% increase in children malnutrition and rising poverty, 1.5 million people left with disabilities and 2 million widows. Poverty, unemployment and poor medical conditions are considered only some of the results of 20 years of U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. Despite the fact that the war is over, people are still facing challenges due to the effects of that war. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Industrial production in the EU's top economy, Germany, has suffered an unexpected decline. It's bad news for the entire bloc. However, a forecast published on Monday suggests the EU's economy is set to grow modestly. But downside risks are also growing.
Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine continues to cast a long shadow of uncertainty over the economy.
Grants to help struggling EU firms will soon be withdrawn, Eurozone finance ministers announced on Monday.
Companies that are receiving support will have to look at how they can support their own long-term viability.
A growing number of people are reaching the conclusion that the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine through constructive dialogue with Russia. The cost of living crisis resulting from the conflict is taking its toll.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful, but you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Apparently, financial markets are looking on nervously because so many things have been impacted by the war.
Due to the fact also of the uncertainties in China,
and lower exports and imports from China, and also due to the expectations of the economy in the United States.
A conference in Brussels on Monday heard that cracks are showing in the EU with respect to the war in Ukraine.
The Europeans has been united, but they need to be much more united.
Trade union members across the EU point out that wages are not keeping up with inflation as the bloc continues to spend billions of euro on arming Ukraine.
Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A great open-hearted and free-thinking Iranian poet, as described by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi in a message read to the audience by the Minister of Culture on the occasion of Persian Language Day. Credited for reviving the Persian language through his literary masterpiece Shahnameh or the Book of Kings, Hakim Abulqasim Ferdowsi is honored every year on the occasion. Persian or Farsi, as referred to by native speakers, is a branch of Indo-European languages. It is primarily spoken in Iran, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, but widely understood in Central Asia. It is considered a relatively simple language to learn grammatically. It is written from right to left using a modified version of the Arabic alphabet. The Saadi Foundation in Tehran has made it its mission to promote the Persian language, Farsi. And Persian Language Day is the best opportunity for that.
Farsi is the key to a treasure chest full of gold coins. Our literature and Persian poems are the treasure inside that chest. I recommend everyone to learn Farsi.
I fell in love with classic Persian literature through the Ferdowsi's Shahnameh. It took him over 3 decades to write the book at a time when Arabic was the main scientific and literary language of Iran.
Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings, recounts Iran's mythical and historical past. The book is considered valuable cultural heritage for Iranians, while it serves as a great inspiration to learn Farsi for foreigners.
Foreigners say Persian is one of the most beautiful languages in the world. Persian Language Day is celebrated on May 15th to honor the world-renowned Persian poet Ferdowsi and his masterpiece Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip marked the 75th anniversary of the Nakba Day, also known as the Day of Catastrophe, in front of the United Nations office. Nakba Day marks the displacement of Palestinians upon the establishment of the Israeli regime in 1948, when Zionists drove out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the historic land of Palestine. According to UN figures, there are currently around 5 million registered Palestinian refugees. Around 1.3 million refugees live in the Gaza Strip and reside in 8 refugee camps under miserable living conditions. The Palestinian Legislative Council in Gaza also held a special session commemorating 75 years of Nakba and called on the international community to stop turning a blind eye to the plight of Palestinians.
Palestinians expressing their disappointment of the UN representing the international community who had created the Zionist entity in 1948, and until now, after 75 years, they are failing to respond to the Palestinian ambitions and dreams of an independent sovereign state.
Palestinian refugees, their children and their grandchildren hold sacred the right to return to the land of their ancestors. 75 years on, Palestinian refugees say they have not lost hope of taking back what is rightfully theirs.
In this 75th anniversary of Nakba, we said our right won't fall down. We as refugees here in Gaza, we said to the Israeli occupation, we will give back to our land. If it's not today, tomorrow, if it's not us, our children, so this right won't fall down.
Every year, as Palestinians mark the Nakba, they are not only commemorating the horrors that took place 75 years ago and the demolition of some 500 villages and towns, they are also marking the Nakba, or catastrophe that continues in different forms to this day. Last Tuesday, the Israeli regime launched a five-day onslaught on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming scores of Palestinians, including innocent women and children.
The Palestinian Nakba of 1948 is still continue. We can see this every day here in Gaza. The last few days, the Israelis have attacked the 2.3 million innocent Palestinians, killed 33 Palestinians, wounded dozens, destroyed dozens of houses.
Nakba Day is commemorated annually by Palestinians and by millions of those who support them and their cause around the world.
Nakba Day is special for the people of Gaza, where most of the inhabitants are refugees and children of refugees. Despite decades of displacement, they refuse to give up the right of return to their hometowns and villages. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In Canada's largest city, young Palestinians have taken the lead in remembering 75 years of resistance and the ongoing displacement and dispossession faced by Palestinians with the commemoration of Nakba Day in the streets of downtown Toronto.
The Zionists once upon a time said that the older generation will die and that the youth will forget. And we are here today proving not only that the youth will not forget, but that the youth will take up an active role in our people's struggle for national liberation. We believe that we have a responsibility to confront Zionism in our locales, wherever Zionism is.
Well, 75 years of occupation, 75 years of crimes against humanity. We're here to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And we want liberation. We believe that we are the generation of liberation.
Journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, murdered by Israeli troops 1 year ago, and political prisoner Kader Adnan were remembered among the numerous martyred and hundreds injured since the start of the year in historic Palestine amid an increase of violence by the Zionist occupation forces.
In the West Bank, we have seen continuous raids on cities like Jenin and Nablus, and these attempts have been to quell the youth that is rising up, resisting the settler colonial state that is taking away their rights and their right to live in dignity. We have seen home demolitions across historic Palestine in 48, in Al-Naqab, in Sheikh Jarrah. We have seen Palestinians being displaced. We have seen political prisoners succumb to their to medical negligence, a policy implemented by the Zionist entity intended to make sure that our political prisoners are effectively being slowly assassinated.
And so we are here saying that our prisoners carry the struggle forward and are our compass, that we will honor our martyrs and uphold their legacy. And we call on Palestinian youth and Arabs all across the world to play an active role in our struggle for national liberation.
Activists from a wide range of organizations are calling on Canadians to support Palestinian resistance by opposing Canada's contribution to Palestinian dispossession and joining the demand to end the illegal occupation. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad addresses the Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia after more than 12 years of suspension from the bloc. He says the occasion is a historic opportunity that could open a new phase in Arab cooperation. This comes as some Arab countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, are parting ways with the U.S.-led West in one way or another. The willingness to normalize ties with the Israeli regime does not seem to be there anymore. Are we witnessing the beginning of a new era in the West Asia region? And will these new developments lead to more unity and cooperation among the regional states? Those are just some of the issues we'll be looking at on Spotlight with our guests. Journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes joining us from Belfast. Also joining us tonight, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah McNair joining us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Fra Hughes in Belfast. What is the significance of seeing Syria back in the Arab League?
Hello, everyone. I have to say, first of all, it's a damning indictment of all the Arab regimes in the region who turned their back on Syria during its hour of need. I would include Saudi Arabia, which has seemed to be the kind of progeny for ISIS and for their financial backing, for their arms and for their part of their political ideology. The fact that Syria has in some respects, won the war against America, the EU, Britain, Israel, and other regional parties who were determined to destroy the Syrian regime, to bring the Syrian people upon their knees, to destroy the country, to possibly instill a caliphate-type fundamentalist grouping, and destroy civil society in Syria. That has obviously failed. And what we are looking now is at a rapprochement between not only Iran and Saudi Arabia, but a rapprochement now between Saudi Arabia, who mainly back the ISIS terrorists, and Syria, and indeed now Turkey and Syria, if Erdogan is re-elected. So we're having, we're witnessing a burgeoning, blossoming a new Arab-Persian detente. The irony is not lost on me that Syria is being invited back into the Arab League in Saudi Arabia. I think really what we're witnessing here is a continuation of Saudi Arabia's distancing itself from the American regime. What we had with Biden when he was elected in 2020, he more or less described the Saudi Arabian leader, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, as a pariah because of the Khashoggi murder. And from that, there seems to be a distancing from Riyadh to Washington. And as Saudi Arabia drifts closer into the sphere of Iran, and indeed Russia and China, and joining BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the future for the whole of the Middle East and West Asia is okay, with China and Russia as a conduit between the two countries.
Let's see what Mr. Magnier thinks about the issue. Elijah Magnier in Brussels, 12 years of absence, but Syria is back now. That's quite a hefty amount of time. Where actually would be a good area to restart this readmission?
I think today is a historical day,
because we are seeing the return of the Arab League to Syria and not the other way around, because the Arab League was in the arms of the Americans, careless about what's happening in the Middle East, relying about all the problems and the conflict in the Middle East on the US and NATO, following the US policy, not looking after the interests of the Middle Eastern countries, normalizing with Israel and rushing in the arms of the Israelis and getting far away from the Palestinian cause. What we have seen today is the return of the Arab League to Syria and to the right cause of the Arabs, the Palestinian cause, the issue of the Arabs sorting out their problems together. The meeting today was extremely important because the Americans were very upset and expressed that overtly by Foreign Minister Antony Blinken, saying that they do not agree with their hosting of Syria in the Arab League summit, and the Saudis continue with their plans, disregarding what the Americans dislike or like. Also, the same was the position of the European Union. This is a very clear indication of the decline of the US empire and the losses of their influence worldwide, where the Saudis are trying to create a balance between their interests, and that didn't happen before, and the interests of all the countries with whom they would like to maintain good relationship, and that includes Syria and America, Iran and Russia and China. This balance that we are observing in the Middle East, in countries where they were totally submitted to the US dictate in the past, that is the news today. The news is the Arabs are no longer considering their godfather in Washington as the reference, but they're looking after their own interest. And it is in their interest not to be close to Israel, but to be close to one another, return to Syria, and be close to Syria, reconstruct what they have significantly participated in the destruction of the country, that needs between $300 to $500 billion to rebuild what the Arab, supported by the Americans and NATO, destroyed and caused in Syria, and division of the Syrian by Syrian leaving the country in several millions and dividing the country in the attempt to change the regime.
Farah Hughes, let's go back and look at this from a different perspective. Who was behind the suspension of Syria from the Arab League in the first place? Many would say it was the U.S. And the U.K. Who actually benefited from Syria being suspended from the Arab League? And with it, who are the losers from Syria coming back now?
Well, you've already mentioned the main participants in the destruction and the occupation of Syria. I think the people that were pushing for them to be kind of kicked out of the Arab League would have been America, NATO, the EU, Britain, and whatever influence Israel had at that time in the background. This was part of the process of isolation of Syria, of demonization of Syria, of putting forward the propaganda that, that this was a civil war and that the people were rising up in a people-led revolution against an autocratic dictatorship. That's not the case. The people of Syria have stood firmly beside Assad, the Syrian president, in order to protect the Syrian Arab Republic and the Syrian Arab army. So the destruction and the isolation of Syria was based on Western foreign policy. So it was American foreign policy that pushed to isolate, to demonize and to occupy and indeed to terrorize the Syrian people. So the people who have won are the Syrian people. They haven't liberated all their land. We know that almost one third of the country is under foreign occupation. Hopefully that will change. The people who have lost are those who wanted to destroy Syria as a bulwark against Zionist expansionist ideas and plans in the region. And I think that the other people who are the main beneficiaries are indeed the Palestinian resistant movements. It is indeed Iran, which has stood beside Syria throughout this last decade. Indeed. When we consider the Arab countries denied Syria any type of support, it was actually Persians and it was actually Hezbollah, both Shia-led administrations, who came to the aid of an Arab Muslim country, which is to be gratefully received.
Elijah Magnea, what will this develop mean for the resistance axis in the region?
Well, first of all, pushing away Israel, that's a very good step, because now we see the Arabs moving away from normalization with Israel. Secondly, we start hearing again the Palestinian cause adopted by the Arabs, rather than just leaving and dropping it completely. A third is the reconstruction of Syria. If the Arabs are serious in reconstructing Syria, that will be very positive on Syria. And the fourth, that is very important, at the summit, they all agreed on the integrity of the Syrian territory. This is what Russia and Iran were advertising for the last years, during the years of war. And now for the Arabs to recognize that, it means they support the withdrawal of the Turkish occupation forces, the Americans and NATO occupation forces in the northwest and in the northeast for the Americans. And that is great, because Syria needs to regain its control over its oil and food basket that is in the northeast and that the Americans are preventing the Syrian from reaching. So all these are perfect elements. Now we need to see if the Arabs are serious in the reconstruction of Syria, because the presence of the foreign troops, I don't think any foreign troop will remain in Syria if the danger is no longer existing. Therefore, there is no need for Syrian allies to remain in Syria if the jihadists are outside the country, the Turks are outside the country, and the Americans and NATO are pushed out of the country, or if they decide to leave. Therefore, this is a very good statement by the Arabs, who again emphasize on the unity of Syria. Now, how that is going to implement it is not going to be easy, because neither the Turks nor the Americans are willing or expressing any desire to leave Syria alone.
Frau Hughes, how will Syria's return to the regional arena affect efforts to normalize relations with the Israeli regime? Now, given the circumstances, do you think that the so-called Abraham Accords, they look a little shaky now?
Yes, I think fundamentally what we need to look at is which countries, which regimes, and which governments can still be influenced by the Americans in the region. I think the greatest actual danger to the region at the moment is if Erdogan is not returned to power in Turkey. I think that he's moved away partially from NATO. He won't arm the Ukraine. He has distanced himself from America because they tried to have a military coup against him in 2016. So Turkey will be a linchpin in whatever peace process develops in Syria. I think the axis of resistance is strengthened because we have seen one Arab country, with the help of others, including Russia, stand up and defeat the proxy army sent in by NATO and the West. I think that as Saudi Arabia moves away from America and closer to Iran and closer to Syria, and the war in Yemen ends, we might see a resurgence of not Arab pan-nationalism, but of a regional consensus that sees Israel as an apartheid terrorist state, but also sees the machinations of Israel within the region. And maybe pressure can be brought on countries like Morocco, who continue, and maybe the UAE, who continue with normalization processes with Israel. So far from isolating Syria, perhaps the Arab League should now isolate Morocco and the UAE and other countries that are normalizing with what is a terrorist state, whose sole aim in the region is to destabilize and destroy its neighbors by any means possible.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Elijah Magnier, Saudi Arabia was expected to normalize ties with the Israeli regime a while ago, but now it has restored relations with Iran and with Syria in a span of a few months. Why did that happen? Do you think that Saudi Arabia distancing itself recently from the United States in fact contributed to the rapprochement between Riyadh and Damascus?
I think it's more than that. I think it's the U.S. proxy war on Russia, on the Ukrainian territory. And because all the objectives of the Americans, most of the objectives, most of the American objectives have failed, we didn't see Putin separated from Russia. We didn't see the Russian economy in tatter, as Ursula von der Leyen said. We didn't see the sanctions affecting the Russian economy to the point that the Russians are crippling toward the Americans, begging them to stop. And we've seen how all the European economy is deteriorating. The inflation is hitting the continent, is even hitting the Americans, who are no longer capable of paying their debts and are struggling with that. And then we see how countries around the world are using more or less the Iranian model that Iran has adopted decades ago by using an alternative currency, by turning toward the East, by establishing relationship with other countries than the U.S. And this is what's happening today. This is what we have seen, how the Saudis and the Emiratis refused to increase the oil production during the OPEC Plus meeting, bringing down the production to 2 million barrels. We've seen how the Saudis are selling oil to the Chinese with 30% with the Chinese local currency. And we've seen how the BRICS countries are using their local currency among themselves. So all that is a mixture of so many elements that brought the Saudis and the Arab countries to think again that Israel is really not bringing them where they want to go, because today the Americans are in trouble. Their hegemony is shaking. They are no longer the masters of the world as they have been for the last 70 years. And now they have to defend themselves and survive. And they have a real challenge that coming from many countries like Russia, China, Central Asia, South Africa, Brazil, India, Pakistan. So many countries today are giving up on the obedience to the U.S., and this is why is giving another thought, particularly to the Saudi, who wants zero problems in the area and have a project to reconstruct and boost the Saudi economy in 2030. This is why they are reconciling with their neighbors. They consider Iran is a regional power that can no longer be disregarded. They accepted the influence of Iran over several countries, like the influence of the Americans, like the Saudis have some influence, and they recognize they have been engaged in useless wars in Yemen and in Syria and trying to cripple Lebanon with the Americans. So they lift all these problems away because they understood that the Americans manage the conflict. They don't solve the conflict. And the Saudis don't want any more problems because they want to turn toward resolving their own problems in the Middle East, and this is what brought them closer to Iran, closer to Syria, and today we heard what they are saying. We want to sort out our problems between us.
Elijah Magna, I'm going to stay with you for this last question. What does this mean in terms of the Syrian conflict itself? Will the Arab League be able to help Damascus end the presence of foreign forces, namely American and Turkish troops on Syrian soil?
I don't think so. I don't think the Arabs are going to push that far from the beginning. Today we heard the Saudis in their communique, they're saying they want to do step by step with the Syrians. So they want Syria to make some move toward the return of the refugees or to reconciliation among Syrians, which is something that Iran, Lebanon, Iraq has been calling for many years. So if this Syrian make this step, then the Arabs will have to justify with the Americans, because they don't want to be the enemy of the Americans, but they don't want the American control. So creating a balance is going to be a challenge for the Saudis, because the Saudis are the ones who are pushing forward. We have to remember that Kuwait, Qatar, and Morocco were rejecting the idea of having a meeting, a summit with the Syrian. So it was the Saudi pressure. So the Saudis are pushing forward the wheelbarrow and pushing everybody behind them. And this is where they need to invest, because the return of refugees, several million, will need a serious investment. They need to rebuild the infrastructure of the country. And that came after the visit of President Raisi. So even the Saudis, from the business point of view, they don't want to see the Iranians taking on their own all the business of reconstructing Syria, because there is a good business to make there. So they want also to be part and saying, well, we are not leaving Syria. It's a country that we have to bring in, and this is what they have decided to do.
One last question for Fra. He's addressing the gathering. Bashar al-Assad said that this could be a historic opportunity to address regional issues without foreign interference. Is that what the region is edging closer and closer to? No more foreign interference in affairs of the region.
Well, if there was no more foreign interference in the region, then you wouldn't have countries destabilized from Yemen to Syria, to Libya, to Afghanistan, and everywhere else. In fact, the best thing possible is to end Western hegemony in the Middle East. I think that what the president has alluded to and what he has said is the future for the region. I think that when Saudi Arabia was in the proxy war after the Iraq-Iran war, which was pushed by America and the West, they then pushed Saudi Arabia into conflict with Iran in the from the 1980s and the 1990s on. So once countries in the region stop being influenced and stop influencing